Good morning, everyone, to you all, and welcome to the first lecture of 2019 Palliative Care Lecture Series. Hospice NZ would like to thank and acknowledge Cancer Research Trust New Zealand for their generous support and funding to deliver these free lectures. The lecture today will be recorded and it will be available on the Hospice New Zealand website. Please be aware there will be an opportunity for questions at the end of the presentation. We would now like to introduce our guest speaker today, Professor Stephen McFarlane, who is Head of Clinical Governance for the Dementia Centre, Hammond Care Australia. Welcome, Professor McFarlane. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you for the introduction. As you go through life, you tick off a number of things on various bucket lists, and today is one of those. It's the first talk I've ever given while still dressed in my night attire. It's 7:30 here in Melbourne. And 5:30 in the morning here in Melbourne, 7:30 in New Zealand, so it's a bit of an early start for me. But thank you for the invitation to talk. A couple of disclaimers, perhaps, to start with. Although I'm talking to you on palliative care and dementia this morning, I don't consider myself by any means an expert in palliative care. In fact, I first became aware of the problems associated with palliative care and dementia only a couple of years ago when I began working with the Dementia Centre. The Dementia Centre here has a Commonwealth Government contract to provide behaviour management services to people with advanced dementia in residential care here. And we run two programs, the Dementia Behaviour Management Advisory Service, or DBMAS, and also the SBRT, or Severe Behaviour Response Team, which deals with those with really quite significant behavioural disturbances that might otherwise place them at risk of loss of accommodation or hospital admission. And it was during our early days with the Severe Behaviour Response Team in the first 12 months of operation, we noticed that about 10% of people who were referred to the service in fact ultimately revealed themselves or were to be revealed as requiring palliative care because their presentation, which is actually not with behavioural disturbance associated with dementia at all, but was a presentation consistent with terminal agitation. So we tried to turn our minds to various factors which might help us differentiate phenomenologically whether any given individual with dementia was suffering from behavioural and psychological symptoms of dementia, or BPSD, or in fact terminal agitation. And that's a theme that we'll be returning to this morning. I'm aware that we don't know what each other doesn't know, so I apologise if some of the material that I present is already well familiar to you, but I'll try and be as interesting as I can. Next slide, please. My only real involvement with palliative care in the setting of dementia had been with Rod McLeod in what's, I believe, now the eighth or ninth edition of the palliative care handbook that Hammond Care, my employer, has produced for some years. In the latest revision of this book, it was observed the previous editions didn't really cover the topic of dementia at all, despite in Australia now some 450,000 people living with dementia, all of whom are destined to die, and all of whom are entitled to good palliative care. So in the latest iteration of this book, the ninth edition, we have tried to at least start to add material that might be of benefit to clinicians who are looking after people living with advanced dementia who require palliative care. This book's available online, presumably through all good booksellers as well. Next slide, please. I mentioned that we'll be spending a lot of time this morning trying to differentiate terminal delirium from non-terminal delirium and also from generalized behaviors from which people with dementia suffer. But let's have a look at the scale of that problem, first of all. Various prevalent studies which have looked at the rates of behavioral disturbance in dementia found that they're very high. Up to 90% of all those with dementia will have some degree of behavioural disturbance associated with that condition at some point during the course of the illness, bearing in mind that the commonest form of dementia is Alzheimer's disease, and that runs an average course of about 10 years. So over a 10-year period, 90% will develop behavioural disturbance. Big issue for someone who works in dementia care is that there's a great overlap between the sort of symptoms that people with dementia might experience as part of their dementia illness and the overlap of symptoms with delirium. And this isn't just restricted to a terminal delirium or a terminal agitation. You know, garden variety delirium that we've all seen, very hard phenomenologically to distinguish it from BPSD, which is why taking a history is so important in individuals who are acutely confused or who are confused and are seen cross-sectionally in the emergency department. Very hard to tell just by looking at people and looking at their symptoms whether they're behaviourally disturbed from dementia or their delirium. This is compounded, this difficulty, by the fact that the biggest single risk factor for any form of delirium is any form of pre-existing cognitive impairment, because people's cognitive reserve, you know, by definition, has already been exhausted once you're suffering from cognitive impairment from dementing conditions. Add to this sad fact the fact that over 70% in Australia, at least, of residents within long-term care will have a dementia diagnosis. Delirium itself is extremely common. Many studies have shown rates in hospitals of up to 30% of elderly general medical inpatients having delirium, up to 50% of elderly orthopedic surgical inpatients will have delirium. So it's a very common condition. But we don't actually know what the rates of delirium are in long-term care. I've not really been able to find any studies that have done the prevalence of delirium in long-term care settings. But presumably because the risk factors for delirium are so high within that setting, that it's a very, very common condition. And certainly it's a common source of referral to emergency departments and to primary care in the long-term setting. Superimposed delirium upon a dementing illness. Given that part of our task is to try and differentiate behavioural symptoms of dementia from those of garden variety delirium and ultimately terminal agitation, delirium is usually not fatal. It does have significant morbidity and mortality associated with it. I think about 10% of those who become delirious in hospital or who are admitted with delirium will die within 6 months. That's a poor prognostic indicator. It's frequently recurrent. We don't know whether one episode of delirium is going to result in a terminal agitation leading to death or will resolve spontaneously or with treatment only to recur a few months later. And again, it's all very well trying to find an underlying cause for delirium, which is the basic principle of treatment. And if you do find an underlying cause, I suppose it's more likely that the delirium will resolve. We simply don't find a cause despite adequate history and investigation in up to 40% of cases with delirium as well, and that's been well established. So all of these things conspire against us to produce the clinical dilemma of what is behavioral disturbance in dementia versus symptoms of a garden variety delirium versus those of a terminal delirium or a terminal agitation. I actually prefer the term terminal agitation. That's probably because I work with people with severe dementia, and what we see is the symptoms of agitation that lead to the referral. So I might alternate between the use of those two terms whilst acknowledging that some people and perhaps the palliative care field prefer the term terminal delirium. Next slide, please. Let's look at the state of play of palliative care at the moment and what are the characteristics of people who receive it. This article's fairly old, but I don't think the picture overall has changed with what I've read of the literature subsequently. Who receives palliative care? This is a paper that came out of West Australia in 2006. And in the abstract, it stated that fewer than 1 in 10 who died of non-cancer conditions in Western Australia received specialist palliative care. So in other words, the vast majority of palliative care recipients had a cancer-related condition. Of those who didn't have a cancer-related condition, 8% received specialist palliative care. A fair proportion of those would have had dementia or Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's in Australian women is now the leading cause of death, for example. It just shows that against the 450-odd thousand individuals who have the condition, really very few of them can be expected to receive palliative care during their last phase of life. Next slide, please. Let's look at the situation overseas. Western Australian people might be outliers. There's data from the US, again, fairly old, but you know, still reasonably reflective of the current state of play. Only 1.5% of people with end-stage dementia received palliative care in the USA, was the state of play 20 years ago. And in Europe, a more recent study, fewer than 1% of patients admitted to hospice have a neurological disease, which of course includes Alzheimer's and other dementias, but also other neurodegenerative and physical neurological conditions. And paradoxically, perhaps it's been suggested that the very behaviours that might indicate a need for palliative care in dementia may, by virtue of their very existence, perversely serve to exclude them from appropriate admission to hospice care. And we'll perhaps talk about the reasons why that might be the case shortly. Next slide, please. So why these low rates? The first point is that to accurately identify the end stage of life in dementia is really difficult. All of the reasons we've just discussed, the fact that terminal delirium or terminal agitation is very hard to differentiate from BPSD, the end stage of delirium, of dementia, sorry, is really quite prolonged. It can drag on for a year or more, so picking the appropriate point perhaps to admit somebody to hospice care is very difficult in a disease that has a long decline period. The cancer literature that we have available emphasises the occurrence of terminal agitation and behavioural symptoms in the last few days of life. In dementia, you know, this behavioural disturbance period may be drawn out over weeks, months, or in certain cases be recurrent or continuous for a year or more. Perhaps the audience might be able to comment on whether hospice staff have appropriate dementia-specific skills to manage people with advanced dementia. One of the paradoxes of working in the field of dementia behavioural disturbances in long-term care, where you might expect the staff to have appropriate skills to look after people with dementia, is that even those who work with people with dementia on a daily basis and care for their daily needs within residential care don't seem to have the appropriate skills, at least in Australia. And if that's the case for people who supposedly look after people living with dementia every day, I can't imagine that dementia-specific skills in palliative care are that common. We can perhaps take that question up later at the end. Maybe there's also a stigma associated with BPSD and dementia. Maybe the staff don't want the other patients disturbed or don't want other families disturbed by people with dementia causing disruption within the unit. Again, perhaps the audience is a better place to comment upon that than I am. Next slide, please. So what happens to those with advanced dementia who live within long-term residential care? What are the outcomes? How long can a person with dementia be expected to live within the long-term care setting? Morrison and Sue back in 2000 found that 6-month mortality, so 6 months, those with severe dementia who had a hospital admission with pneumonia or a hip fracture, 53% and 55% respectively. So those particular conditions where they lead to hospital admission were pretty strongly associated with death within the next 6 months compared to the subsequent rates of death, which are 13% and 12% respectively, and those who are admitted to hospital with the same conditions but who lacked a dementia diagnosis. Of note, and this is just a sidebar really, there's plenty of research that shows that those with dementia who undergo hip fracture are prescribed analgesia at significantly lesser rates than those who are cognitively intact. This particular study found that only 24% of those with dementia and the hip fracture received any regular analgesia at all. Other work, notably from Subi Banerjee in the UK, has demonstrated that even when people with dementia do receive analgesia for hip fractures, the average dose is about 50% of that which cognitively intact people receive. I'll just mention that in passing. Mitchell has done a lot of work in this area, looking at predictors of death in those with dementia, and she found an excess of greater than 50% mortality at 18 months in a cohort of those with advanced dementia, and certain clinical indicators were associated with increased rates of death. The six-month mortality of an episode of pneumonia was close to 50%. Any unexplained febrile episode was reasonably predictive as well. The occurrence of eating problems, presumably with associated weight loss, had a high six-month mortality. And she also found that over 40% of those who died within 6 months were actually admitted to hospital and underwent a burdensome medical intervention within the last 3 months of their life. So those are things to watch out for clinically, and certainly when we're considering palliative care referrals within the severe behaviour response team now, we look at such things like hospital admissions within the last 6 months, an increase in the number of general practice visits to the person, an increase in family involvement with the person in the previous 6 months, significant unexplained weight loss within the last 6 months, which reflects the eating problem issue, and also any episodes of fever or frank pneumonia in the previous 6 months. We bring those things into consideration when we're considering palliative care referrals for our people with dementia within the service. Next slide, please. This is where I might be trying to teach you to suck eggs. Many of you may be aware of the gold standards framework that came out of the UK a couple of years ago for predicting the need for end-of-life care from a general practice setting. So this document came out of the UK and the Royal College of GPs. It provides a flow chart of fairly simple approaches to trying to identify the need for end-of-life care across a variety of medical conditions. It's not limited to dementia necessarily, but still might provide a useful guide for those who see people with dementia regularly. Flowcharts shown on the next slide, number 9, and highlights the use of what the authors refer to as the surprise question. Would you be surprised if this person were to die in the next year, the next few months, the next few weeks, or the next few days? If the answer is yes, regular reassessments to see if they have general indicators of decline, which we summarized on the previous slide, eating problems, weight loss, febrile episodes. If there are specific clinical indicators that clinical decline is occurring, the gold standards framework process of identifying individuals, assessing them for their current needs of care and planning for their future care should kick in. So a process of proactive identification guidance for anybody with an advanced medical condition who might be approaching end of life, and particularly in dementia. The surprise question is of particular relevance as we move to the next slide. So what are these indicators of the need for end-of-life care in the setting of dementia? How does the surprise question perhaps relate to those with dementia? And how good are doctors at actually picking the need for end-of-life care in people living with dementia? We'll move on to slide 11. Thanks. Again, this is work from Mitchell. We conducted a cascade study in 2006, Choices, Attitudes and Strategies for Care of Advanced Dementia at End of Life, or CASCADE. She looked at 323 nursing home residents with advanced dementia and found that there was a 55% mortality at 18 months with a median survival of 1.3 years. So this is even in the setting of advanced dementia. What's advanced dementia? A reasonable rule of thumb might be an MMSE of less than 10, I would consider to be advanced dementia. But even in that group, the median survival is over a year. over an 18-month period, there were very high rates of pneumonia, febrile episodes, and eating problems once again, and the adjusted 6-month mortality rates after the development of these specific problems were in the order of, you know, approaching 50% at 6 months. So again, those specific three clinical indicators seem to differentiate those who are more likely to die at 6 months compared to the much higher median survival of 1.3 years. Interestingly, surprisingly perhaps, she found that other major acute illnesses such as fractures and myocardial infarcts were rare in the last 3 months of life. So it wasn't usually an acute medical event that precipitated the deaths of the people within the cohort. If we move to the next slide. Mitchell's made attempts to develop diagnostic tools for use in the end-of-life period within dementia. She developed the Advanced Dementia Prognostic Tool, or the ADEPT tool, some 9 years ago now. This is a 12-item additive score. It includes information on age, gender, level of functional dependence, you know, sort of demographic things, nutritional status, presence or absence of various symptoms and medical conditions such as congestive cardiac failure and shortness of breath. She's attempted to validate this tool in quite a large sample with advanced dementia and quite a high specificity of 89%, yet a sensitivity of only 27% for predicting death within 6 months. And I'd argue that a tool with a sensitivity of only 27% is not necessarily of much clinical use when you're trying to make decisions about the allocation of scarce hospice resources, for example, and distributing an under-resourced palliative care team across a large number of people. Next slide, please. What sort of symptoms do those with dementia experience in the last week of life? This is the Dutch end-of-life study, which I gather many of you will be familiar with. It looked at a group of people with dementia in the last week of life and looked at the prevalence of symptoms including pain, shortness of breath, and agitation within that last week. They found very high rates of all three, and if you had a combination of, you know, one of three symptoms compared to two symptoms compared to one symptom, you were more likely to die as a result. This is not necessarily surprising, and again, the audience will be able to tell better than I whether this is reflective of the broader population in the last week of life. But it brings us back again to this dilemma in dementia of the fact that agitation and behavioural disturbance, very, very common, of the referrals that we see in the severe behaviour response team, 90% of them will have agitation as a symptom. And as we mentioned at the top of the talk, only 10% of the SDRT cohort actually have been then demonstrated to require palliative care. So it's a non-discriminative symptom in the population with dementia. Similarly, one of the good bits of data that's come out of SBRT and its cousin, the Dementia Behaviour Management Advisory Service, that we found that in probably about two-thirds of all our cases of people with dementia and behavioural disturbance, either under-treated or indeed unrecognised pain has been a significant factor in driving those behaviours. And as we mentioned before, the vast majority of people in our service, including those with significant pain, don't actually die during our episode of care. So this data from the last week of life, again, brings us back to the problem of differentiating symptoms that are predictive of death versus those that are simply very common within the setting of dementia and behavioural disturbance. Moving to slide 14, this slide illustrates the point. This is a PDF produced by the Hospice of Cincinnati that highlights the symptoms of terminal agitation in people who are dying. And these symptoms aren't specific to dementia in any way. They apply to anybody who's in the terminal stages of their life. And if you look at the list of symptoms on the left there, the sort of things that people experience as part of a terminal agitation, there's a vast overlap between the symptoms of terminal agitation and the symptoms of PTSD. Is there any solution to this problem? You know, have people done better and Mitchell, for example, in trying to develop predictive scales or approaches to end-of-life care or the identification of the need for end-of-life care in those with dementia. Let's move on and find out. Aminoff in 2004 produced a scale, and I wish they'd chosen a better name for it, because it's for a geriatric psychiatrist who uses the MMSE on a daily basis, the MSSD, or the Mini Suffering State Examination of Aminoff, is very confusing. But Aminoff looked at the presence of these 10 factors in people with palliative care needs, and found that a high score on this scale was indicative of high suffering, which should be an indicator for the institution of palliative care. So non-specific indicators such as behaviour that is not calm, whatever that means, the presence of screaming, pain, ulcers, malnutrition, eating problems, whether there'd been an invasive medical procedure in recent times, whether the person has an unstable medical condition, whether they're felt to be suffering according to their attendant medical staff, or suffering according to the family opinion, gives you a low, intermediate, or high score on the MSSE scale. The next slide shows Aminoff's attempts to try and validate this in a series of patients in 2006. Looked at 134 consecutively admitted palliative care patients who survived less than 6 months. And they found that there was a significant correlation between low, intermediate, and high MSSE scores and the subsequent survival in terms of days. In other words, it's an inverse correlation. If you had a low score, you'd survive for an average of close to 2 months. If you had a high score, your survival was halved, 27 days, and that was highly significant statistically. But there's some utility in that scale. And again, the audience would be best positioned to tell me whether or not a stay in palliative care of 27 and a half days is considered exceptionally long in terms of hospice or palliative care stays. The next slide, again, is a proposal from Aminoff that came out of the use of the MSSD scale. He proposed the development, or he or she, I'm not sure, proposed the development of what were referred to as relief of suffering units, which were somewhat distinct from palliative care units and were felt to be best situated within existing health services, including hospitals. And the idea of these relief of suffering units was that they would be specific to people with end-stage dementia, whose care was currently spread across a variety of hospital settings. And you walk around any tertiary hospital and you'll come across people with dementia who are dying in medical settings, surgical settings, orthopedic settings, and subacute geriatric settings as well. So these relief of suffering units would draw suitable patients from feeding units, whether that be medical or surgical, according to identified need, presumably using the MSSE score as an admission criterion. These units acknowledged that the prediction of death in this cohort was an unreliable science, so admissions to the relief of suffering unit wouldn't mean that you were destined to die, and it was certainly clear from the model of care within their units that those who did improve would in fact be then discharged back to long-term care. In other words, there's an acknowledgement that there would be a certain degree of false positives in admitting people to these relief of suffering units. And I'm hoping that someone in the audience would tell me whether any of these actually exist following their proposal by Aminoff some 11 years ago now. Slide 18, this is a more recent study that was published in the Australian Journal of Ageing in 2013. The Reach Out in Dementia Toolkit was intended to enable practitioners to recognise end-of-life care and to institute holistic care as a result of that recognition. The evidence of the need for end-of-life care was based upon signs and symptoms of end-stage dementia, been identified. It's been piloted and validated in long-term care settings and basically relied upon the presence of 8 signs or symptoms, the presence of one or more possibly indicating the need to change to a palliative approach within that long care setting. So those 8 factors in no particular order: the person was dependent in all activities of daily living, was doubly incontinent, suffered severe communication impairment, had eating or feeding difficulties, and we see this eating difficulty arise again and again as an issue as we go through the various studies. The loss of mobility, the loss of walking, followed by loss of ability to stand, the presence of contractures, persistent confusion, agitation, behavioural symptoms, withdrawal, lethargy, apathy. So, perhaps symptoms that might be consistent with a delirium, but which fail to resolve spontaneously as one might normally hope. Presence of recurrent infections and a complete lack of recognition of family, friends and everyday objects. Now, to me, it's a useful scale on the face of it, but I've seen many, many patients who have existed with 1, 2, 3, or 8 of these conditions for many, many months and still survived within long-term care. So although it's likely to identify all those who might be requiring palliative care, I still suspect that it will count a lot of people in who don't actually need that intervention. As we go to slide 19, and this is the final slide I have before we throw it open to questions, comments and abuse, don't forget that although dementia is a terminal illness, it's a long, drawn-out terminal illness, and people with dementia will often die, if not usually die, from or with another pathology rather than because of dementia. So most people with dementia will die with it rather than die from it. So in other words, there's nothing about people with dementia that stops them from developing cancer or severe cardiac failure or other conditions that would be appropriate indicators, even within the current state of play, for admission to palliative care. Yet we still seem to exclude people living with dementia from those services in many settings. So dementia coexists with other pathologies, and that these coexistent pathologies, and this again is something that we found within the severe behaviour response team, if you've got significant cardiac disease or significant pain or significant anemia, anything that's a significant medical problem can also drive these behavioural and psychological symptoms of dementia as well. And I think we do tend to under-treat general medical conditions in people with dementia, probably just because they have dementia, in much the same way as those with severe dementia don't receive either any analgesia at all or at best inadequate analgesia in general medical settings and in hospital settings. So I thank you for your attention. I see we've come in with a couple of minutes under my allocated 40 minutes, which is probably ideal.
Thank you, Professor.